I don't know if he's hurt or where he is, if he's cold, if he's hungry, if he's sick, and we just don't know.
Family members continue the search for a man missing from Nome. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska oil industry workers worry about job security.
I could probably find other work. Not sure if it would be in Alaska. So a move to the lower 48 probably would be plan B.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
A woman died in state custody early this morning. Corrections staff found 48-year-old Laurel Christine Hunter unresponsive in her cell around 2:30 a.m. Medical staff attempted life-saving measures while awaiting emergency medical responders. She was pronounced deceased at the hospital at 3:10. Hunter had been booked into the Anchorage Correctional Complex on July 4th for driving while intoxicated. She was being monitored and treated for an acute medical condition. DOC spokesperson Corey Allen Young says between security and medical checks, staff looked in on her approximately every hour. No foul play is suspected. Allen Young says the department is investigating to see if anything could have been done to prevent her death.
There is an investigation ongoing with the Alaska State Troopers and the Medical Examiner's Office, but also with the DOC's Professional Conduct Unit, and there will be more information that comes out on that.
This is the sixth death at a Department of Corrections facility this year. Alaska State Troopers say the body of a missing 4-year-old Fairbanks boy has been found inside a fish wheel in the Chena River. Troopers say they were notified shortly after noon on Tuesday that Owen Yoakum had left his home without his family noticing. Troopers say the family was worried the boy might have gone toward the river, which is close to the family's home. Family members and neighbors searched the area along with troopers and other responders. Troopers say the boy was found in the fish wheel and was taken to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, where he was pronounced dead. The body was taken to Anchorage for an autopsy by the State Medical Examiner's Office. It's been a week and a half since Joseph Balderas went missing in the foothills outside of Nome. Alaska State Troopers suspended their search for the 36-year-old man on Monday, but his family, friends, and even those who didn't know Balderas continued on. KNOM's Emily Russell joined a search team yesterday and has the story.
It takes nearly an hour to get to mile 44 on the Nome Council Highway. That's where Joseph Balderas' truck has been parked since he was reported missing June 27th. On a clear day, you'd see the Bering Sea to your right and the mountains on your left, but today it's raining. It's day 9 of the search, and the rain feels like a reflection of the increasingly somber mood. Selena Hargis is Balderas' sister. She flew in from her home in Hawaii and has been out searching every day since Friday.
I mean, it's hard because you come out here and, you know, I don't know if he's hurt or where he is, if he's cold, if he's hungry, if he's sick, and we just don't know.
That's been the most frustrating part for a lot of people, not knowing. What they do know is that Balderas talked about going running or fishing in the area. I asked Hargis how she would describe her brother, and she's quick to respond.
Adventurous. Very adventurous.
He was always adventuresome and outdoorsy, and you know, he's from West Texas, but said that he had sort of thought that, he'd always sort of thought that maybe he would end up spending time in Alaska.
Elvio Sadoun went to law school with Balderas at the University of Minnesota. He flew up from Los Angeles with two friends to join the search. They've helped make up what many are calling the largest search and rescue effort Nome has seen in decades. Early on, the Coast Guard sent a Jayhawk helicopter from Kotzebue, which joined a wildlife trooper helicopter, as well as chartered and private fixed-wing planes. But the biggest wave of support has come from community members. Every day, dozens of locals fill up their trucks and ATVs with gas that costs $5 a gallon. Sadoun says they've tried it all.
We've had to sort of, like, form and then ultimately like reject a lot of different narratives. And I think each time we're kind of optimistic, like, oh, well, let's recreate a run that he might have done, or let's recreate a fishing excursion or a hike or whatever. And then each of these times we try that and exhaust it, and then we have to come up with a kind of different idea, different theory.
Today's theory is one of desperation. We stick to the creeks and riverbeds, thinking that if Balderas is still alive, he'd try to reach a water source. We walk north on the tundra above a creek and eventually turn back, walking through the water. There's no sign of Balderas. Rain lets up halfway through the day. Snacking on trail mix and a bag of chips, people shed layers and hang them up to dry for a few minutes. The plan is to spend the last hour scanning the riverbed near his truck for a four-piece fishing rod he's thought to have taken with him. We're out walking through a riverbed right now, just combing through it. I've got rubber boots on, but that doesn't really quite help because they've filled with water walking through wet willows earlier today. It's a little eerie. We haven't seen anything. You think he's gonna be around here somewhere, at least his fishing pole, and you just don't see anything. The feeling of failure sinks in on the drive back to Nome. Balderas's three law school friends are leaving on the evening flight, and one of them, Cyrus Jamnajad, stares out the window in defeat.
As we have 1 hour before we fly out of here, it doesn't feel good at all. It feels awful, and knowing the family's gonna still stay here, and we didn't find him like we had hoped we would. It's terrible.
Balderas met a lot of people during the last year and a half he worked in Nome as a court clerk. Many of his friends in town showed up to search, but even people that never met Balderas came out day after day. Jamnajad says that's what's impressed him the most.
It's been amazing how many people didn't know him, but came out of a sense of kindness or responsibility or duty. You know, one kid who heard that someone went trail running and was missing, you know, he goes trail running and says, that's what you do for those, you know, people in that situation.
Day 9 was the last day of organized search, but his friends and family say they'll never stop searching on every run, every fishing trip, and every hike through the mountains. Because, they say, Joseph Balderas would have done the same. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
Governor Bill Walker has signed legislation allowing for national criminal history checks on people applying for licenses for legal marijuana businesses in Alaska. The provisions sought by state marijuana regulators were tucked into a bill dealing with alcohol laws. Cynthia Franklin, director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, says by email that the language will allow staff to send fingerprints gathered in the application process to Alaska's Department of Public Safety and the FBI. She says her office doesn't expect that the histories will be run by those agencies before the law becomes effective in 90 days. The Marijuana Control Board has been issuing licenses based on applicants' sworn certification that they do not have a disqualifying criminal history. If the background check shows they do, Franklin says the license will be subject to immediate suspension. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new exhibit explores math as art.
I processed a base shape through with their equations, and we get a form that looks, in fact, very much like a flower.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska has lost more than 2,000 jobs in the oil and gas industry since last year, as the state faces its first real recession in nearly three decades. This week, Alaska's Energy Desk is spotlighting those who have been affected by the downturn as part of the series An Uncertain Future. Tony DeHaven can't afford to be out of work. He has two teenage kids with their college years just around the corner. So far, DeHaven has been lucky to hold onto his job as an automation engineer on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, working for the engineering firm Downland Bach. But he worries about the future.
Well, I feel privileged. I really do. at the pipeline, you've got a team of people who work 24/7 controlling everything from the central command location. And they use the systems that I built for them every single day. Yeah, it's a little bit of a scary time right now because, you know, the pipeline's kind of on a hiring freeze. You know, as an outside contractor working for another company that's just supplier, it's always a little scary to say, oh, well, let's trim back the contractors, which, you know, contractors actually make up probably the majority of people working on the North Slope. I'm kind of in an awkward spot right now just because I've got a daughter ready to go into college and a son who's not far behind. And so I'm sort of putting all my savings into their college funds and to my retirement fund. And so, you know, as a dad with two teenage children, it's cash liquidity is not a great thing right now for me. Plan B obviously is always in the mind. I feel like my skill set is such that I could probably find other work. Not sure if it would be in Alaska. I think that would be hard to find, you know, not a lot of people being hired right now in Alaska. So a move to the lower 48 probably would be plan B.
Tony DeHaven works for Dowland Bach, an engineering firm. His story came to us from Alaska's Energy Desk, a new collaboration between Alaska Public Media, KTOO, and KUCB. You can find more stories from the series, An Uncertain Future, online or on Facebook. Look for Alaska's Energy Desk. A pay increase should be a happy time in a person's life, but for some, it can evoke fear. That's because more money earned could mean less money in pocket when public assistance programs get cut off. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has this next story as part of a series called Chasing the Dream.
Rebecca Dundore owns Juno Treasures Thrift Store with her husband. It's a place that's filled to the brim with eclectic used items.
A lot of kitchenware, some electronics. We have.
Their shop is doing well, so well they're opening a second location that will sell mostly secondhand furniture. But in the course of running their business, they've ran into some issues with staffing. They have three employees right now who make between $10 and $12 an hour. That's more than Alaska's minimum wage. But when they've offered pay increases or more hours, they didn't get the response they expected. One employee was worried she would lose her public assistance.
We wanted her to work almost full time, and she couldn't do it because she has six children and they're on food stamps. And, you know, we wouldn't be able to give enough to get her off the food stamp support entirely. And she wasn't able to take any more because she was afraid she would lose the food stamps.
Rebecca says it was an awkward situation. They've even had employees volunteer to work for free, so as not to make too much money and wind up going over.
That's a really serious concern for a lot of people around here.
Per capita, Alaska has the most households on public assistance in the nation. That's according to stats from the U.S. Census Bureau. Anna Shecky and her husband are one of those households. Anna works for Rebecca at Juno Treasures.
Rebecca's my friend, she's my doula, she's my boss. Like, it's just really great.
Anna decided to transition to the part-time job after learning of her pregnancy. Before, she worked in a stressful environment with at-risk kids, and she hoped the move would be good for her and the baby. But it meant losing the family's insurance, so she signed up for Denali Kid Care, a Medicaid program.
And then due to the major drop of income, we also were trying to get on WIC.
That's food and nutrition assistance for women, infants, and children.
So all of those things were kind of looming over us, and we had to sit down and start crunching some numbers.
With her first WIC voucher, she was able to stock up on canned goods, milk, and some veggies. It helped supplement what they got at the food bank. When she started at Juno Treasures, she was making about $10 an hour.
All of a sudden, they're like, hey, you're doing a great job. We want to offer you more hours and more pay. And I just kind of like looked at them and was like, I don't know if I can do this. I had to sit down again and start crunching like pennies, basically, to see if we could still keep these benefits, which we really needed, and yet be able to make enough money to survive.
She says the WIC office advised she would be on the cusp of making too much. To be eligible, she couldn't make more than $3,800. Her gross household income would be about $4,000 a month. So she decided to drop WIC.
For right now, we've just had to kind of find our little groove and not really swerve one way or the other just because we want our baby to be, you know, covered.
Anna is still covered by Denali Kid Care. The income limit for that is $400 higher. A WIC representative thought Anna might still qualify. Being eligible for one might automatically qualify her for the other. But for the past few months, she's been out-of-pocketing the expense. She wants to grow a garden to help offset some of the cost. Rebecca and her husband, Mark Dundor, say they make enough to keep the doors open at Juno Treasures, but not enough to pay more than $12 an hour.
I think to bridge that gap, we'd have to pay almost $15 to $16 an hour. And small business, we can't, with all the other taxes and fees and stuff, it's just, you just can't do that right now.
But they're trying to figure out how to make it work. One of the solutions they've come up with is to have a bunch of part-time employees. And so I ask them. Some people might be listening to this and they might have the idea that people don't want more hours because they don't want to work more.
I would say that's probably the exception. I think mostly people really want to have the work. I mean, everybody we've encountered anyway has just really worked hard and been really energetic, and we've really appreciated that.
For now, they might have to show that appreciation in a weird way, by offering their employees less. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Two Catholic hospital chains are merging to create the nation's third largest nonprofit health system with more than 100,000 employees in seven states. Providence Health and Services of Irvine, California is merging with St. Joseph Health of Renton, Washington to create Providence St. Joseph Health. The new entity has 50 hospitals in Alaska, California, Montana, New Mexico, Oregon, Texas, and Washington State. The merger was approved by California's Attorney General last month. Today, the new chain announced it will invest $100 million in a foundation and institute to look into mental health research, prevention, and care around the country.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Apollo MT by Guardian Flight. Medevac memberships that protect you or a family member when there is a need for air medical transportation. Information available at apollomt.com.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to a four-year college or other post-secondary education. Explore your talents and develop your dreams at Mount Edgecombe High School. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Alaska's sockeye salmon came back shorter and lighter than usual last year. As sockeye runs return this summer, biologists have been keeping an eye on their size. Fish and Game's Jack Erickson says the return to Bristol Bay is mixed so far.
We're still looking at smaller fish, similar to last year's numbers. What we are seeing is very early in the season. The fish that were 3 years in the saltwater in the ocean, what we call three ocean fish, they're a little bit smaller than last year, but the ones that have been out 2 years in the ocean, they seem to be a little bit bigger. And on average right now, from our very initial catches, it's averaging about the same as last year for size.
Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet also had small fish last year. Erickson is keeping an eye on the size of fish there.
Well, this year in Prince William Sound, we saw fish originally coming in a little bit smaller. But since the beginning of the season, the fish have gotten larger. I think we put on about an average of a half a pound. We've seen an increase in the average size of sockeye. From very initial sample sizes that we're getting out of Cook Inlet, sockeye are probably about a half a pound larger. So in those two areas, we're seeing some improvement, and hopefully we'll see that larger size show up here in Bristol Bay as well.
Fish size estimates come from samples taken at counting towers as well as in the commercial harvest. Although that data is available now, Erickson says, it's too early to draw very many other conclusions about the 2016 run, and the size information is far from final. When it comes down to deciding what salmon to serve for dinner, Bristol Bay sockeye isn't really known by name. The Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association is working on a project to change that. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
How exactly do you sell the 30 million sockeye harvested from Bristol Bay? That's kind of the million-dollar question that's mostly left up to processors and others on the sales side of the salmon industry. But this spring, BBRSDA decided to get more involved. They dreamed up a plan to develop a Bristol Bay brand, kind of like Copper River has successfully done already. And after soliciting proposals from firms both in Alaska and outside, the RSDA decided to hire Rising Tide Communications to help create the brand. Kate Constantine owns Rising Tide, which is based in Anchorage and Juneau. This summer's project is focused on Boulder, Colorado, a place with a lot of self-described foodies, where the RSDA is hoping that millennials might take the bait and buy more Bristol Bay fish.
The message that we're trying to send for this campaign is one that layers in both our taste and flavor messaging with the encapsulation of what an incredible place Bristol Bay is, what an amazing and enduring and sustainable fishery it is, and how we'd like to capture Americans' imaginations about the lifestyle and the fishermen that are working so hard to harvest the fish. So we're calling it Wild Taste, Amazing Place.
This is just round one, a demonstration of what might be possible, and an effort to collect some data about it all.
And the idea is to be able to show every link of our supply chain, a retailer, a processor, a distributor, that when we put some effort into branding Bristol Bay sockeye, that it impacts sales. And that's something that's hard to do when you're working with a commodities brand like Bristol Bay sockeye or Alaska Seafood. We will be able to point to our efforts, show which stores had the best results and which components they used.
Building the brand is both an art and a science. Constantine has done work for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, and she grew up in a fishing family, so she has a feel for the product. But she says she started building the brand by going to the research and looking at what resonates with Americans about Alaskan salmon. So she looked at who might be interested in buying a regionally located seafood brand.
The kind of consumers that want to know where their food is coming from, the stories of the harvesters, the stories of the communities, you know, the heritage and legacy of those fisheries. So we launched from there. Our primary demographic is millennial-aged consumers.
Millennials aren't just college kids. Constantine says the group includes today's 35-year-olds. They're becoming parents, making conscious buying decisions, not just eating ramen. And last year, they surpassed baby boomers in earning power, making them a large group that's interested in where their food comes from. The campaign is also meant to attract other consumer age groups along the way, she says. An ad campaign will use digital media to target millennials in Boulder zip codes. It'll launch in September, focused on refreshed fillets and grocery store seafood cases.
We're planning an extensive retail training program so that we'll be using those staff behind the seafood counter as our best evangelists. They'll know more about Bristol Bay sockeye than anything else they have in the case. And they'll be wearing Grundon's aprons with our logo branded on them.
Just what the logo looks like is still in the works. Constantine says it'll definitely reflect fish and it'll definitely be modern. And while the long history of fish marketing has produced some catchy jingles, Constantine says that's not on the menu this fall. In Dillingham, fingers crossed that eventually we'll have a catchy Bristol Bay sockeye tune stuck in our heads. I'm Molly Dishner.
On the walls of the Bohem Coffee Lounge in West Anchorage hang 18 glass panels. Most are 1 foot by 1 foot, some are bigger. All of them feature brilliant, luminous shapes. The shapes seem familiar, like objects from nature, nautilus shells, flowers, branching capillaries. But as Alaska Public Media's Graylin Brashear tells us, a closer look reveals they're not quite of this world.
There's a depth and dimension in the vivid works now on the walls at Bohem. You almost get the sense that you could reach in and pluck them from their glossy black backgrounds. They are the creations of Bill Lee, an environmental scientist whose first exhibition, Artistry in Equations, will be on display in the gallery through the end of July. Lee says the origin story of the art goes back decades to his final months in the Army. He was stationed at Fort Wainwright, working for a scientist studying the microtopography of the tundra that spread out around them for hundreds of miles. The idea was that beneath the patterns of the landscape, there might be equations that described its natural curves and could be used to recreate it.
We thought, well, what's the characteristic fractal dimension of a particular tundra? That's how I really got kind of hooked into it.
Fractals, repeating patterns that look the same when you scale up or down, have fascinated Lee ever since, and so have other shapes born of equations. And now Lee's sort of doing the reverse of that work in Fort Wainwright. He takes a shape, a specific sort of curve or surface, for instance, and applies equations to it to create something entirely new.
It's sort of this idea that the relationship between mathematics and nature and how they're sort of inextricably entwined. And it starts to beg the question, is mathematics discovered or invented or something else?
The more complex the equation, the more complex and multidimensional the resulting shape will be.
So these are three-dimensional objects that are created on the computer from various equations. And I can visualize them on the screen. I can grab a corner and twist them around, look at them from the top, look at them from the bottom. And I keep doing that until I find something I like. But at the end of the day, what I'm doing with this object that I've created is nothing different than if you were to pick up a teacup and look at it from the top, the bottom, or the side. It's just more complicated.
A lot more complicated. On one wall are mango yellow shapes that look sort of like blooming birds of paradise. Lee created them from an equation that was developed at the CERN Super Collider in Europe.
I processed a base shape through with their equations, and we get a form that looks, in fact, very much like a flower.
It's like almost the tool that you're using to sculpt something.
Right. I don't paint, sculpt, or anything, but I am using math to create a shape.
The colors are applied using equations, too. The final image gets zero reshaping or retouching before it's printed through a special dye transfer process onto sheets of aluminum. Lee says, when you use these mathematical principles as artist tools, there's really no limit to what you can create. In Anchorage, I'm Graylin Brashear.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman and Graylin Brashear in Anchorage, Emily Russell in Nome, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Molly Dishner in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.